Second Court of Appeals. I am Justice Bill Meyer, and I'll be the presiding justice for this afternoon's session. On my right is Justice Dolfino, who is the senior member of the panel that allowed me to preside today. And on my left is Justice Gardner. I will be your panel for your case presented to us this afternoon. And if lawyers are ready, we'll ask the clerk to call the case.
Court calls Oswaldo Reyes versus the state. May it please the court, Ms. Sarah Rowland will represent the appellant, and Mr. Matthew Whitney will represent the state.
Good afternoon. May it please the court, Mr. Whitten. The primary issue in this case, and the one that I'm going to be spending the majority of my time today addressing, is whether a PSI, pre-sentence investigation, that occurs prior to any waiver of rights, prior to any plea being entered, and prior to any conviction, is a critical stage in the proceedings which requires the presence and effective assistance of counsel for constitutional purposes. The issue specifically related to the constitutional right to counsel is different in this case for two primary reasons. First, this case is factually unique. In this case, Mr. Reyes had not yet been to court. He had not yet entered a plea. He had not yet waived any of his rights, and he had not yet been convicted. I think you'll find, when you look at the cases that are cited in appellant's brief as well as the state's brief, when you look at the facts of those cases are different because the defendants in those cases had either already entered a plea, had already waived their rights, or had already been convicted. In most cases, all of those things had already happened, and they had requested that a PSI been conducted prior to its having been conducted. Like I said, this case is factually distinct because none of those things had occurred first.
May I ask a question, please?
Certainly. Yes, ma'am.
Was it Smith? What was the case where Grigson interviewed the death penalty defendant?
Estelle versus Smith. Yes,
okay.
Ma'am.
And he was the court's expert, was he not? Or was he the state's expert?
He was actually an independent, and then the state did use him. Yes, ma'am.
The state used him, but wasn't he appointed as the court's expert?
He was appointed as the court's expert. That's correct.
And isn't the court considered as neutral as a probation officer?
The court is considered neutral as a probation officer, and you are correct. In Estelle, though, in that case, the court did find that that person was required. Estelle was entitled to counsel there. And that holding was fairly limited. It was limited in that it found that competency evaluations are typically conducted by someone who is neutral. Probation officers by title are generally thought to be neutral. But when you're using a finding, in that case in Estelle, it was a death penalty case and the issue was future dangerousness, then in that case, he was entitled, they were entitled to counsel at that stage in the proceedings. And that court specifically did address how counsel at that stage, at that competency hearing, could have effectively prevented them from going into those findings that were detrimental to Estelle in that case.
The psychiatrist took it upon himself to go further than the competency and inquired into the circumstances he could use to recommend future dangerousness.
That's correct. They did talk about future dangerousness in the same way that's similar to this case in where the probation officer wasn't limited in his questions to the specific facts in appellant's case. He talked about extraneous offenses and asked about past conduct as well as the relationship with the complainant, the injured person, the victim, I guess, in this case. So it wasn't limited strictly to the offenses for which appellant was indicted in this case. So in that instance, Estelle is very similar to the facts, to the procedural facts of this case.
Estelle does seem very similar. I have a question if I can interject.
Yes, ma'am.
At this time.
Certainly.
Estelle, it looked to me like there was no objection made by trial counsel in court to the psychiatrist's testimony. that didn't seem to bother the Supreme Court. There was no objection in this case either. Can you comment on that? What did the Supreme Court say about no objection?
In that case, there was no objection. In this case, likewise, there was no objection. However, in this case, the issue was the identical issue was raised in the motion for new trial that we had. That was denied. In Estelle, though, they still found that that was error and that they were entitled to the lawyer there at that point in time. And we're arguing the same thing here, essentially the same thing, that as the facts go, this PSI was a critical stage in the proceedings where the effective assistance of counsel was absolutely required.
I guess my question is, why did the Supreme Court say that there was no failure to preserve error in this deal?
And I understand your question. I'm not exactly sure specifically what they said in that about the failure to preserve error in that case. I do know that in this case, we did have the motion for new trial where we did. I anticipate that the state will argue that the trial counsel in this case procedurally defaulted any error. What we're claiming is that this is not the type of error, and what they did talk about in Estelle was that's not the type of error that can necessarily be procedurally defaulted. This is a constitutional bedrock principle. The entitlement to counsel is a right, a constitutional right that an accused has. That an accused has to personally waive. In this case, there's absolutely nothing to suggest that Mr. Reyes ever waived his constitutional right to counsel. And in fact, had he known he could have him there, the evidence suggests, the record suggests, he would have had him there. Likewise, his counsel's affidavit, which is part of the record, indicates that had he been aware of the PSI, he would have likewise been there. The decision, because this case is factually different from the others, is one reason why this case is different. The second is the United States Supreme Court decision in Rothgary versus Gillespie County. That was a 2008 decision. If you look at prior cases that have addressed specifically PSIs, most of those occur prior to the Supreme Court's decision in Rothgary. And what we know about that case is it did not specifically address a PSI, but it did address attachment and it did address critical stage in the proceedings. There's no argument here, I don't think you're going to hear any from the state, certainly, that attachment had already occurred during this case. The state, at this point, when the PSI occurred, was fully invested to prosecute. They were prosecuting, in fact. The issue is whether or not that PSI was a critical stage in the proceedings. The constitutional right to counsel attaches at all post-attachment proceedings. Now, there's no specific definition of what constitute a critical stage in the proceedings, though the Supreme Court has made clear there are three factors to consider when you're looking at whether a stage is critical in the proceedings. The first is it an encounter with the procedural system? In this case, I think there can be no question but that this was an encounter with the procedural system. This was a PSI with a probation officer. You can make the analogy that in Rothgary, that was an initial appearance before a magistrate, a judicial officer, an officer of the court. In the same way, probation officers are sometimes termed officers of the court. Rothgary was the initial appearance before that judicial officer was a critical stage of the proceedings for that same reason. Here, when you have an appellant who's in custody prior to any plea, waivers, or conviction, who's being questioned by a probation officer about the facts of the case as well as extraneous offenses, I think there can be no question but this was an encounter with the procedural system that was already designed to prosecute him. Yes, ma'am. He was clearly in custody during that time, and he was interrogated and asked about the specific facts of the case. We also raise in our brief a Fifth Amendment issue. I've just chosen to spend the majority of my time today on the Sixth Amendment issue, but you're absolutely correct that there is a Fifth Amendment component to this as well, especially, and you'll you'll see in the brief that what happened procedurally and factually, what happened was the case was set for an open plea. At some point in time prior to the open plea, in fact, the day before the open plea, the probation officer went to the jail, visited with appellant. The day before he went to the jail, though, appellant received a letter at the jail from the probation officer that said, you're required to fill this out if the if the court is going to hear your case, if it's going to be pled out, or for TDC purposes. You're required to fill this out. That's part of the record. Appellant filled that form out. He wasn't just asked about the form, though. He was asked about additional things instead of just what's on the form. And you can see, because it's part of the record, the probation officer's notes. The probation officer who testified at the motion for new trial specifically said that he asked appellant questions and follow-up questions, not just based on the answers of appellant in that questionnaire that I guess the state could argue is neutral for PSI purposes, but the probation officer also asked appellant questions based on information that the probation officer obtained from the state's file at some point prior to the PSI.
So, who all did the probation officer make the PSI available to?
The PSI was made available, according to the record, to the state, to the defendant, and there's no specific mention that the court, the trial judge, never specifically mentions that he looks at it, specifically in the record. The state questioned appellant from it, and the probation officer did say that he provided it to defense counsel on the morning or on the day of the open plea. The prosecutor did specifically argue for a greater punishment, and he used information obtained in that PSI in argument of aggravating or enhancing, I guess, elongating the sentence. He absolutely made reference to the PSI, specifically what was on appellant's mind in that, did you intend to do this? Did you mean to do this? And prior instances of drug use and drug dealing. And the prosecutor absolutely hounded on that and argued for that in giving a lengthy prison sentence. The second factor on what can make a stage critical for purposes of the attachment of the counsel is whether the interaction presents a risk that a defendant's and accused's right to a fair trial could be prejudiced. I think, again, certainly there can be no question that such an uncounseled PSI interview at the jail, where a probation officer has a complete copy of the state's file, including investigator notes, does present a risk that an appellant's right to a fair trial can be prejudiced. Just because a case is set for an open plea, even if appellant had already been found guilty or pled guilty, he still has a Sixth Amendment right to counsel, and he still has a Fifth Amendment right not to testify in Miranda. Those rights are still intact, and they're not extinguished just because this is a bifurcated proceeding. The third factor to consider in whether a stage is critical or not for constitutional purposes is whether the nature of the PSI in this case is such that counsel could have eliminated or mitigated some harm. And I think that there's no question that counsel, any competent counsel, would have immediately halted any kind of questioning related to extraneous offenses. Any counsel worth his salt would have stopped that questioning right away. Article 1, Section 10 of the Texas Constitution provides similar protection. The difference there, the Court of Appeals has articulated, and that was in Medley versus State, that whether a particular part of a trial process is a critical stage is determined not by whether the accused suffered some prejudice by the absence of counsel during that part of the proceeding, but whether critical rights can be lost at that stage in question. Again, critical rights absolutely can be lost at that stage in question. The state still retains the burden to prove extraneous offenses beyond a reasonable doubt, even if an accused has pled guilty or been found guilty. In this case, I do expect that the state will make much of the fact that the accused procedurally defaulted his rights. Again, what we're contending under Marin is that this was the type of rights, these were the type of rights that could not procedurally be defaulted. And this is the kind of case that is so factually distinct and different, it kind of gives you a gut check on it. It's wrong. It's if you hear that a probation officer was equipped with the whole prosecutor's file, goes into a jail and questions an appellant before he's ever entered a plea, waived any rights, or been convicted, and questions him not just about the offense at hand, but about extraneous offenses, that's abhorrent to the constitutional bedrocks that we have, the right to counsel, the Fifth Amendment right. So those are the reasons that we're arguing today. And
so the prosecutor met with the probation officer, provided the probation officer with the prosecutor's file.
Yes, ma'am.
Does Denton have an open file policy as far as the defense, ma'am?
Yes, ma'am.
But it was the prosecutor who made the file available. Was there any evidence of any discussion between the prosecutor and the probation officer? Or?
There is no evidence of any discussion, no, ma'am.
Okay.
Thank you. Oh, yes, ma'am. I have a question
about the record. Does the record show whether an order was entered by the court for the pre-sentence investigation?
No, ma'am. There's no such evidence, no such mention of that in the record at all.
Okay. Thank you.
Good afternoon. May it please the court, counsel. I would like to just briefly address three things. I would like to talk about the preservation issue briefly. I'd like to talk about the Rothgary case in particular and some of appellant's harm arguments, and just briefly try to address some of the questions I think that have been left open by the briefing and appellant's arguments here today. First of all, just quickly, there is no record that the state or any prosecutor met with anybody from the probation department or had any discussions or anything like that.
And did you get the prosecutor's file?
It's not reflected in the record, Your Honor.
Okay. It's just that there's no record.
There is no record, and I can leave it at that.
Well, how would a probation officer even know what to ask unless he had a file to look at before he went over to interview him? Wouldn't that be routine that he would obtain a copy of the record?
Yes, Your Honor, and in fact, the probation officer did talk about that at the motion for new trial hearing and essentially stated, yes, when the court asks us to do a PSI, and as far as the record shows, he testified that, yes, the court asked his department to do a PSI. That as a matter of course, he basically calls up the DA's office and gets a copy of the file. I don't know that he ever talked to an actual prosecutor or anything like that. As far as preservation goes, I do want to address one thing in particular in the appellant's reply brief. I think that the appellant maybe confuses this waiver issue with one of forfeiture and preservation of error. Under the Marin case, the holding of that case is actually very, very narrow, which is if a trial court has a sua sponte duty to do something, then that right, whatever right that may or may create for a defendant, is something that's waivable only and would therefore possibly be permissible to bring up on appeal for the first time, but that's simply not what we have here. The statute that creates this PSI procedure doesn't create any kind of sua sponte duty on the court, especially not in this situation where a PSI wasn't even actually required.
Sua sponte duty on the court to what?
To do a PSI. In other words, there's nothing in the PSI statute that required the court to do a PSI.
So you're saying the defense requested it?
No, the defense did not request it. At least that's not reflected in the record. And in fact, the defense attorney's affidavit reflects that he didn't know that the court had requested a PSI. Apparently, the court didn't tell anyone. But it doesn't matter because nothing in the statute prohibited the court from ordering one on his own. It wasn't required, but he did.
When you now, question a defendant, particularly a custodial questioning of a defendant, by any officer, either of the court or the police department, well, if it's a police officer, there does have to be a Miranda warning. Gregson was supposed to have given a warning to Smith before he questioned him on behalf of the court. Is there an obligation before beginning to question a defendant who's in custody on behalf of the court to give him the warning that he has the right to have a lawyer present and a right to remain silent? Or does the letter telling him he has no choice but he's required to fill out the questionnaire and presumably answer the questions, does that somehow conflict with the requirements of Miranda?
The Texas cases in other jurisdictions, as I've pointed out in my brief, actually say that the trial court is not required to admonish or even talk about the PSI to a defendant before the PSI or before the plea.
Has the Supreme Court ever said that?
The United States Supreme Court, as far as I know, has not said that. But in Texas, at least some of this court's sister courts have held that.
How about the Court of Criminal Appeals?
The Court of Criminal Appeals, again, on like in many of the issues in this case, has not spoken. However,
I think they'd be bound by Smith.
Estill case.
Estill v. Smith.
Yeah. Yes.
Estill was the director of.
Well,
the Department of Corrections, so it's Smith.
That case is distinguishable because there it's pretty clear that the psychiatrist went out of bounds compared to what happened here, and there's nothing in the record here to indicate that the probation officer ever did anything that was acting as an arm of the state or going into something that the PSI statute wouldn't have allowed him to go into. And so I don't think that we even need to reach that question.
So extraneous offenses, unprosecuted, uncharged offenses, that's okay?
During the PSI? During any PSI,
so
yes.
No and limit I think, on a PSI, right?
I'm sorry?
There's no limit on a PSI. There's no right to counsel, no limit on the questions the probation officer can ask, and they're all made available to the prosecution. Is that your position?
The PSI statute specifically says that the PSI is not to be made available to anyone until the hearing begins, which is what happened in this case. And at that point, there's no indication that the trial court used it. The defense and the state both apparently had access to it when this hearing began. They were given a copy of it. But the statute does place that limit.
Okay.
On
if the state's asking questions from the PSI, how can you, with a straight face, say the court never had any information from the PSI?
And the state specifically argued that increased sentence should be given because of his drugs that was selling.
That's actually a debatable point. Now, let me address both of these things. First of all, it absolutely was permissible for the state to address something that came up in the PSI after the defendant himself took the stand and lied about his intent. And the state asked one question, apparently out of the PSI, about the appellant's intent. During closing arguments, the state mentioned it once. As far as extraneous offenses and drug use and things like that, the appellant himself had taken the stand during trial and testified about all of those things himself. It's not necessary to even reach a PSI issue there, whether you're talking about whether it was permissible or if it wasn't, whether it was harmful.
Was the PSI made available to defendant's counsel before the defendant elected to take the stand and testify?
Well, I'm not sure when he decided to testify, but yes, he was given, all parties were given the PSI apparently at the beginning of the proceeding that morning. And so, yes, the counsel had an opportunity to review it and certainly use it. And, of course, it's important to note he never made any objection. And as to the preservation issue, you can't say, first of all, the appellant's not, has not shown any authority of any Texas court saying that this is the kind of fundamental, either this Fifth or Sixth Amendment complaint that he is bringing, that this is the kind of right that cannot, that can be brought on for the first time on appeal. It doesn't fit within the Marin framework, and it's just not the kind of case we have here.
Wasn't it brought for the first time on appeal in Smith?
The issue in Smith was different, though. The issue in Smith was the psychiatrist.
Oh.
And
it's different?
We're talking, respectfully, Your Honor, we're talking about a PSI and a procedure laid out by statute, which, by the way, this proceeding was done as a unitary proceeding, which is...
The psychological examination is provided by statute any time you have the issue of future dangerousness.
The future dangerousness in a capital case, first of all, that issue goes to an element in a capital case, the issue of future dangerousness, that has to be decided.
It's a punishment issue.
That's correct. And here, there nothing that was done as far as the PSI goes to any actual element of the offense, and as far as being a punishment
Sorry,
issue.
Sorry, future dangerousness is not an element of the offense. It's a punishment issue. So we're talking punishment and punishment here.
Okay. And as far as a punishment issue goes here, this is distinguishable because the probation officer, and there's nothing in the record here, did anything out of bounds. There's absolutely no basis for making that assertion that the probation officer did anything out of bounds. You would have to...
What did Grigson do out of bounds? He did a future dangerousness evaluation.
But apparently Grigson had set out with the end of stating that there was that future dangerousness would be a problem in that case. There's no indication on this record that anything of the sort was going on. As far as Rothgary goes, if I may move on.
I'm going to ask you to reflect on the statements in both briefs about the status of Texas authority on the question of the critical nature of this aspect of this trial when there was not a plea of guilty and that the process that happened on May the 28th was the start of a hearing in which there was to be a plea accepted on an open plea as well as then to proceed to the issue of punishment. Now, what authority is there in the state that reflects on whether in those circumstances the matters involving the PSI, like what we have here, are brought into play?
The authority is the same case as I've cited, because no matter whether it was done prior to plea or prior to conviction or prior to any admonishment, the end result is the same. If he had been admonished, if he had already pled, if he had already been convicted, and the Fifth Amendment rights or the Sixth Amendment rights did attach to a PSI, it's no different than whether he hadn't pled or hadn't, because if those rights attached, they attached. If they didn't attach, they didn't, and it doesn't affect the analysis. And the Texas cases are clear that the PSI is not a critical stage, and the Texas...
In some jurisdictions.
Yes, this court, other courts of appeal in this state have routinely held that it is not a critical stage of proceeding. That is correct. And as far as any Fifth Amendment right goes, again, other courts of appeal have routinely held that there's no need for admonishment, Mirandizing, prior to a PSI. And
are you
so,
aware with Nellie Bird Carroll case, the 1, 2, 3, and 4 of Nellie Bird Carroll?
I'm sorry, Your Honor, I'm not terribly familiar with those.
That is a case about Fifth Amendment, a right to remain silent during punishment, and the fact that you cannot obligate a defendant to provide any information or to waive a right to remain silent at the punishment phase of the trial. And that's from the Court of Criminal Appeals in response to the Supreme Court's holding that the right to remain silent applies at both phases of the trial, and you cannot compel a defendant to provide evidence. Is it standard practice in Denton County to do PSIs without notice to counsel or before the trial starts? Or
I have two very important answers I would like to give to you on that. Okay. First of all, as to standard practice in Denton County, I can't answer that question thoroughly. It may depend on the court. This particular trial court judge is no longer on the bench. As far as the cases you're talking about, what I would add to that analysis is that here the appellant did testify at his hearing and did testify as to all of these things that were also contained apparently within the PSI. And if we get into a harm analysis, and this, I'm certainly not conceding that there was, but if we were to talk about that, which I did want to talk about, there's nothing to indicate that this contributed to punishment given the very small focus that was put on it. And I see I'm out of time. Are there any other questions?
Thank you very much for your presentation.
Well, thank you.
With my brief time left, I'd just like to address a few things. First and foremost, your inquiry about whether this is common practice in Denton County, and there's certainly not evidence in the record to reflect any common practice in Denton County, but yes, that's the common practice in Denton County for probation officers to go and visit or conduct PSIs prior to the entry of a plea, and most of the time, nobody ever complains about it because, quite frankly, most of the time there's an agreed plea and the judge accepts whatever agreed plea that is. So you never hear of anybody complaining about that most of the time, but that is the common practice. Secondly, I do want to address the state said there were some issues left open-ended in our brief, and I guess by our presentation, the issue of preservation harm and then the analysis in Rothgary. The reply brief that we filed last week covers all of those issues, and I think quite fairly extensively. Thirdly, in the transcript, and it is the volume 3 of the transcript, at page 10, that's in the hearing on the motion for new trial, there's an exchange between the probation officer and appellant's counsel, wherein appellant's counsel is asking the probation officer, so you specifically asked Reyes questions based on the information you got from the DA's office? Yes. And you ask him follow-up questions you got from the information from the DA's office? Yes. It's clear that at least at some point there was communication between the probation officer and the prosecutor, if nothing else, to get a full and complete copy of their file. We talked about Estelle. I want to also talk about two other cases that I think can be analogous to this situation, and one of them is this court's opinion in Garza versus State, and that's 18 Southwest 3rd 813. And that's an opinion from 2000 wherein a CPS worker met with the accused while he was in jail, knew he had a lawyer, and he answered questions at that point in time. He got out of jail, and the CPS worker asked him to come back. He came back and talked to the CPS worker. In that case, this court found that the CPS caseworker was acting as an arm of the prosecution and that the statements were deliberately elicited from Garza in that case. And that case dealt with Fifth Amendment But that's a case directly out of this Court of Appeals. The second case that I think is of significance and that is similar is in the matter of JSS, a juvenile, and that's at 20 Southwest 3rd, 837. In that case, it's unlike this case in that there was already a waiver and a stipulation. And there, the trial court entered an adjudication order and set the case for a disposition hearing. While the juvenile was in custody, a probation officer visited that juvenile while he was in jail and did the functional equivalent of a PSI without providing Miranda warnings. He knew that this juvenile had a lawyer. Lawyer wasn't there. In that case, the Court of Appeals in El Paso held that the Fifth Amendment privilege against self-incrimination applied to a predisposition report. That's as close as you can get to this case. The facts even a little bit different in that case where there had been a waiver, where there had been an adjudication already. This case, none of those things had happened. And then most recently, this court again on January 13th, 2011, with regard to any kind of preservation issue in Laboriel Giddy, found that that appellant had not preserved error where there wasn't an objection made during trial or where there was not that specific error raised in a motion for new trial. In this case, there was not an objection at the trial court level, but we raised this exact issues, these exact issues, in the motion for new trial. And that's all I have, and I'll tender my time back to the court if there are any other questions.
What's the site on the case you just mentioned?
The Laboriel Giddy case? Yes, sir. It's not yet published, but the Westlaw site is 2011 Westlaw 167257. And that's the number on that is 02-10-00175-CR. Yes, sir. Thank you.
Your case has been very well briefed and well argued. We, the court, appreciates you all giving such a good presentation to us today. And we thank you for your presentation work, both on your briefing and your argument. And the case is submitted, and we will.